Hello, I'm India, and welcome to Start a Ripple, the podcast that celebrates moving in nature. You see, I believe that ripples are made when we connect movement with nature, not only for the mind and body, but also the environment too. And I can't believe we're in the fifth series already of this podcast. So thank you to everybody who has followed the podcast, and I can't wait to share with you the episodes I've recorded for this series. Okay. It's time to introduce this week's guest. Brendan Prince became the first person to paddleboard around mainland Britain in 2021 to raise awareness and funds for his water safety charity Above Water. I chat to Brendan about why he devoted his life to teaching water safety and why he felt he needed to become a record holder to get his important message out there about accidental drowning and how to prevent it. Right, so hi Brendan and welcome to the Start a Ripple podcast.
Awesome, India. Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Oh, it's really, really, really great to have you. I've been following your journey for a while, obviously, as a fellow paddleboarder myself. I have seen what you've been up to and I've been in awe of it. So to get you on the podcast is a real, real treat. But we're gonna go back to the beginning because some people may not know who you are. And given the name of this podcast, Start a Ripple, I like to begin and find out where your ripple started. So tell us a little bit about your background and how you got to where you are today.
I think it's probably important, anyone who's engaged with the water, it always starts at a very early age. And I had the benefit of growing up next to water. And so at the age of six, I was making rafts and, you know, proper swallows and animas and stuff. So that was me from an early age, became kind of an instructor kayaker and all the rest of it at 16. Suddenly realized that perhaps I should turn this into a career. So became a PE teacher and head of outdoor education at a grammar school for 25 years. Meanwhile, I did lots of kind of expeditions. So as a 19-year-old, I kayaked the upper part of the Indus in the Himalayas through to climbing in lovely places all around the world. So kind of expeditions and things like that were all part of an adventure soul, I suppose. Taught for 25 years. And most people who have taught for that long, kind of that's what they do for the rest of their lives. But you know, certain things happened in my life which changed that, and significant things to totally change your life direction, and that's where the kind of new adventures came in. But I've been paddleboarding for 2003-2004, sort of the first paddleboards.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's quite early on, really. It's such a new sport, really, isn't it?
I mean, in the bigger picture, yeah, it's not been around very long. But the boards back then were barges, probably the best way of describing it. I still got an original board, and it weighs the same as a small car, for goodness sake. It's crazy. Very different technology that's involved now, thankfully. Very different.
And obviously, you know, you are best known for paddleboarding around Great Britain, which is a mammoth, mammoth feat. But I think it's always important to kind of remember that people that do these main things, they were once beginners, you know. And so I'd love to hear about your first experience on a paddleboard, if you can remember it. You know, what was it? Where were you? And how make you feel? And how did you go from that to paddleboarding around Great Britain?
Well, I think it was the North Coast. I think it was the North Coast of Devon and Cornwall. And I'd been given this board to try out. And it was quite novel in that standing, and people were, you know, literally pointing and laughing, sort of, what is this guy doing? You know, surely you should be sat down. And my background from surf lifesaving is surf skis, which are, you know, you sit on them, really long, sit on them. And we used to play games all the time where you stand on them because they're like pencils. So you stand on them and do stuff. So didn't feel that unusual, really. But it was more a case of, well, all right, so I'm standing up on this thing. What do you do now? Where's the hook here? Is it surf? It didn't seem surf because these boards were too big. and heavy and bold. But once you started getting into a wave or had the ability to just stand up and see life, it's a very, that 6 foot that you've got does mean you can see so much more. So I did actually get it very quickly in the way that you could see your surroundings in a very unusual and different light. So I was kind of hooked from the start, and it just meant that when there was no surf or there was no, I would go and do stand-up paddleboarding. The start, I think, I'm a big advocate of the 10,000 hour thing. You've got to do something 10,000 times or do it for 10,000 hours to be proficient at it. And you've got to learn and respect the fact that if you're new to something, you've got to give it the time. And even when I started paddleboarding around Britain, the paddler I was, having paddled 15 years more than that at that stage, the paddler I was at the end of that was a far more proficient paddler in so many different ways. And so you're continuing to learn, you're continuing to develop your technique, your understanding, and as you know, as a paddleboarder, it's very much more about the conditions around you that enable you to have a good or bad day on the board than you yourself. And it's how you use those conditions are so important.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. You know, you have to kind of be at one with nature, don't you, when you're on that board. And you know, speaking of the long paddle that you've just mentioned, well, that's what it's ended up being called, isn't it? The long paddle, your paddle around Great Britain. Can you just tell me how you came about this? So why did it happen? Why did you end up going from, you know, having a bit of a play around on the North Coast to doing the whole of the coast? Quite a jump.
So my life changed when I had a number of incidents where lives were lost in the water. And as a lifeguard and somebody who's in the water pretty much every single day in some form, you know, you're always seeing incidents, accidents, and it got to the stage where this was becoming too much. And from a health and well-being perspective, I needed to do something about it myself. So I set up Surf Life Saving Club in Torbay. I set up a charity called Above Water. It's a water safety and education charity, which sends lifeguards into schools and all those sort of training, elements of what we should be doing in this country in an island nation. And I needed to do the next. I needed to get out there more. I needed to get a bigger voice, should we say, and do something that would give me that bigger voice. And it was actually came to a crux in one particular lesson where I was teaching a class of 14, 15 year olds. And they were, to say the least, that the teacher used the opportunity to just give them to me and then disappear. And I love all that. I could think of nothing worse than better than engaging with kids that other people think is the worst nightmare. And we're having lots of fun and we're teaching about rips and talking about rips. And this one kid wasn't, he was hard to kind of nut to crack. And he said to me, "Do you know what? It would be, you know, if you were some type of world record holder or something like that, I'd probably listen to you a bit better than I am now." So we had a bit of engagement about that and chatted about the values behind what's the importance of world records. And it's very much in society that there are elements of society that, you know, unless you've got 10,000 followers on Instagram, they're not really interested in. So it was kind of thinking, well, actually, can I do something that does enter into that a little bit more? It gives you a little bit more, in their eyes, kudos before you walk into a room. And I thought, well, what am I good at? I'm pretty good at paddleboarding. So let's see if we can. And I pride myself on my ability to understand the conditions and be out in all weathers and adventure paddle. And I've been doing adventure paddling for 10 years, really, and adventure swimming, you know, open water swimming for a long, long, since I was a little. So kind of combining all that together, I thought, well, surely it's just a case of leaving Torbay, turning right and keep turning right until eventually I come back. Little did I know that obviously when you're doing these sort of expeditions, the planning, preparation, the involvement from all types of Coast Guards through to everybody else. It suddenly turned into a very big project. But thankfully, a project that was so much fun to do, lasted a lot longer than I perhaps envisaged. I did it in a year when it was particularly windy, 2021. And also, not only was it windy, but if you look back at the last 10 years, the predominant conditions would enable a clockwise direction being the best. But in 2021, to go anti-clockwise would have been far better in the way the conditions actually panned out. But that's the way it is. You know, you take every day as what unfolds in front of you. And to do an expedition which highlights what I'm trying to achieve by demonstrating good practice in some of the best and worst conditions you could possibly imagine was exactly what I was trying to do. You know, at no point was I going to be rescued or need to be rescued, because I was demonstrating that even though paddleboarding is a fairly ridiculous thing to try and do a circumnavigation, you know, far easier to do it on a kayak, to do it on something where you're less as a, you know, you're standing up on a board, you are basically a sail acting against the conditions the whole time and balancing on something the whole time. So not the easiest of tools to do it on, but it really demonstrates to people what can be achieved when you know what you're doing and you understand the conditions and you've got everything in place to make it as safe as possible, especially at a time when, because of lockdown, the paddleboard sales and everybody getting involved in paddleboarding, especially in this country, in Europe, just went through the roof. You know, there were 10,000 paddleboards being sold every week in the UK.
And also what was scary is a lot of them were these really cheap boards that, you know, you were getting off, what's that website, like Alibaba.com or whatever it's called, where they're absolute rubbish. And that's what I found the scariest during that time, seeing these people with these really cheap boards, no idea of the conditions, just seeing a nice fancy picture on Instagram and thinking, yeah, I want to mimic that. It's scary. It was actually quite scary. So one day, I remember actually having to stop and let people pass. And I was like, I am in a paddleboarding traffic jam right now. What is going on? It's crazy. But did you sort of have this sense of responsibility that you needed to kind of get your message out there? And you weren't able to do it as you were doing it as a lifeguard, as a teacher. You needed to, you felt like this message wasn't getting through and you needed to do this. It was like a higher power telling you, like, this is the only way through.
Yeah, it was kind of let's face it, water safety, it's not a sexy subject, is it, for goodness sake? If you kind of sit down with a bunch of kids and say, right, we're going to talk about water safety, mm-hmm. you know, if you went about it like that, you switch off in a second. Mm-hmm. And adults are the same, you know, because they think they know about water mm-hmm. safety anyway. So as soon as you try and engage and talk about water safety, the shutters come down. So if you can do something that they're interested in, today you paddled from, let's say, the north coast of Devon to Wales. Crikey, how did he do that? And all of a sudden they're paying attention and watching and learning without actually knowing that they're watching and learning. And at no time did I talk about water safety, but they would have seen the way I did it and all those elements, and be subliminally kind of learning at the same time.
And I guess you must have come back with so many stories and examples from that trip of where you maybe could have been in danger, got yourself in danger, or had to do some problem solving. And have you got any sort of stories that you can share, you know, especially ones where your mind, your body were like, what is going on?
Jag, I've got a million stories, you know, a million stories. And before every day, because you can't plan this in advance, you have to take every day as it comes, because every day the weather's different. Every day you're not quite sure what time you're actually going to be starting to know what the tides are doing and the flow is doing. So I'd spend 2 or 3 hours every day before, somewhere in that day, working at the next day. Mm-hmm. And to give a kind of an understanding of, I often get people to name a place for me and then I say what happened at that place, because it keeps, you know, so name a bit of the coastline anywhere in.
Okay, I live on the Kent coast, so I live near between sort of High Folkestone that way.
Right. So Folkestone, for example,
quite a plain Jane route, or it's not too wild there. Well, we're in the channel, I guess. So
yeah, as soon as you get into those areas, you've got the shipping lanes, and you've got those to deal with.
That's true.
And you've got to get permissions to cross certain shipping lanes. You've got to understand the flow, because actually around there as well, you know, not only have you got the main flow, you've got other movements and the way the weather goes up and down the channel and the Thames and around the whole of Kent. And it actually, I found that incredibly interesting paddling around, and just more humans, you know, so many more humans to deal with. And all the natural elements are pretty easy to deal with. It's human elements that make it more complicated. But I mean, somewhere like Folkestone, I would have had to have got permission to cross at a certain time, the shipping, and to know what ships are coming in and out. So that then, the backlog of that is, well, actually, I was probably about 30K away from Folkestone. So was I doing Folkestone in that day? Could I get it in those tides? You know, so you have tidal gates, we call them. And, you know, by 2 o'clock, I need to have passed this point to stand any chance to get to the Folkestone element at this particular time. So every day involved that, which meant that some days you didn't hit those gates. Some days, you know, the weather in that area is pretty predictable. You've got, you know, you could be fairly certain 2 or 3 days ahead of what's going on. The only difference that creates is when sun comes out, because you've got more concrete. Suddenly you've got the winds that are created with the movement of warmth and warm air. So that can, from one headland to a next or one town to a next, you've got winds doing things that the national winds aren't doing.
So this might explain something to me now, because I always find that often you get out in the morning paddle, early morning paddle, you're always fine. Come 10 a.m., it's a whole different ball game.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you say, oh, you'll meet a friend for a paddle at like 10:30 because you've gone on a walk at 9 and you're thinking, yeah, this looks pretty calm. No. Is this why then? Because the sun's come up and heated the concrete.
Yeah. So sun comes up.
Yeah.
And concrete warms very, very, you know, once it's warm, bang, it gives off a huge amount of heat. So somewhere like Newcastle, which is right on the water, the heat that comes off Newcastle draws all the air in. You know, if you're passing big fields on the coastline, you know, there's big heat that's coming in. So the land and the sea heat up basically at different times of the day. So when that happens, when there's a natural equilibrium, you know, it's not too different first thing in the morning, it's all very still and very lovely. As soon as that changes one way or the other, depending on the time of the day and the strength of the sun, that totally radically changes, and that's what you get, local winds. So you can use local winds, because you can look ahead, you think, right, well, I know it's going to be a sunny day tomorrow, that wind's going to be doing that. Regardless of what the national weather tells you the wind's doing, local winds are hugely beneficial or destructive to your day, because what local winds create is chop.
Yeah.
They just create chop. They don't create big swell or anything you can work with. They just create chop. So you've got local winds and chop, and suddenly your beautiful start to the day turns out to be an absolute slog because of the way you have to deal with those conditions.
Right. Well, there is my fun fact that I've learned today. This is amazing.
I haven't heard anyone
talk about this before. This is great.
Well, I mean, and you all know that if you're a paddler, how then at 6 o'clock suddenly it all dies and it all goes calm again, because that equilibrium is matched at the end of the day. So yeah, plan your paddles around that. But then, you know, I had 148 days in the whole of the circumnavigation, including Northern Ireland. And only twice in that whole time did what my understanding of the weather, how I'd planned my weather, go horribly wrong. And that's up in Scotland, where you can almost watch the weather happening. And unfortunately, I mean, one particular time, the huge weather system hit the mountains. and it literally just bounced back off at me, and it wasn't meant to do that, you know. And I'm 30k off the coast, nothing you can do about it. So for 6 hours you just literally hold on to your board and deal with it. But then this is the big point, because people say, well, aren't you afraid you're gonna die? No, because I've got all the kit that I need. I've got literally, in those sort of situations, I'd go out and I'd have 3 to 5 days worth of life with me. You know, when I saw that weather system, I actually headed further out to sea, because I thought, actually, the further I go out, the less small waves you get and the more big waves. And you can deal with the big waves. You have to hang on to your board, otherwise it would blow, be taken because it's windy. But you hold on to your board, you're in the water. You know, it was June time, so the water temperature in Scotland was 11, 12 degrees, which is, you know, it's not death defying. And you just deal with that situation. And then it dies down and you think, right, I've got 4 hours to paddle in now. But that is kind of part of it. And I get lots of people that say, do you know what? We would love to beat your record. So I'm actually going to attempt your record next year, the year after, whatever. And they say, can you give me some advice? And I say, well, if you're willing to understand literally what I've just said and deal with it, because you will, that will happen to you at some stage, then crack on. But if you're not willing to understand that, what is ocean paddling, which is very different to beach paddling, then perhaps do another type of world record.
Yeah, because I guess, you know, there's two sides of it. There must, because I'm fascinated about the power of moving in nature for the mind and body. It's sort of what just my brain is constantly like wired about it. And I guess there's two sides of this, isn't it? There's the side that you must feel so much fulfillment, you must feel at one with nature, you must feel like a bit of a superhuman in a sense. And then there's this other side where there must have been times when you felt fear. I don't know, did you feel real fear? Did you feel like, what am I doing? I hate paddleboarding and I hate being out in nature at the same time. I'm guessing the two must sort of have come up against each other.
It's all part of it. Fear is an amazing emotion to channel. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean that from a you know, I'm not belittling fear, but fear stops us from doing so many things. From the littlest of things to, you know, big crazy things. I would wake up, let's say, you know, I knew I was trying to get up and paddle at 5 a.m. because that's when the flow was at its best. And I'd wake up and I'd hear the waves. And often if you can hear them in a van next to the beach, you know that what you're going to wake up and try and get through is not very pleasant. And then, you know, the fear hits you. And then that first look to see, well, actually, before I even paddle the 12 hours I'm going to paddle a day, I've got to get through 10 foot of surf to get out there to then paddle. And I know I'm going to get wet. And I know my kit, you know, it's, you know, there's sometimes when, I timed it wrong and that wave hit me and my kit went everywhere. And I spent the next 2 hours trying to find my radio and
because it was floating in the water.
Yeah, because it I mean, a couple of times I got properly smashed, and you're on a 14 foot board, and 14 foot boards are awkward to deal with in such surf anyway. But as soon as you start putting bags on front and back, you know, they're almost impossible to react quickly, and you know, you stand and you watch, and I might watch the wave system for 15 minutes and absolutely know what the next wave is doing because I follow the pattern, and you watch and watch and watch it, and then you just go for it. And 9 times out of 10, you make it look really good and you fly at the back and you're gone. But there's always that one time where that rogue wave comes in, you think, this wasn't planned for. There's nothing you can do about it, and it just smashes you. Mm-hmm. takes you back to the sand, and your kit's everywhere, and you start again. But yeah, there's fear in that, you know, there's a massive amount of fear in that, but you channel it and you understand it and you rely and trust your own abilities and instincts.
Mm-hmm. And I guess on the other side of that fear is then this sense of accomplishment, this extra confidence, this feeling that you and nature have been, you managed to kind of collide and work together on something. So it is, you can't get have one without the other, can you? And I guess it's
exactly
it's
that
journey that you're on with it. How did your body cope? Because the longest I've ever paddled was 28 miles in one day, and my hands were the shape of my paddle by the end of it. You know, like I couldn't the claws, and my legs, they were like, they felt like tree trunks, and oh my goodness, I was wiped. You were doing this every day for a year, and against the most crazy conditions. So how did your body cope?
You know what, the body, I mean, I got to the stage where I was training so I could paddle for 12 hours. So before I even started, I knew I could paddle for 4 hours, 20 minutes off, 4 hours, 20 minutes off, 4 hours. So I was in a really good place to know that. But after, when I got to Oban, so starting in Torquay, going around the West Country, going around Scotland, and then getting up to Oban in Scotland, my body went, this is really tough. And my, you know, as you said, your hands feel like claws. Even though I'd done that 6 months of training, I was losing a huge amount of weight. I was almost broken at Oban. But at Oban, it was almost like my body said to me, okay, we get it. This is what you're doing every single day now, and there's no breaks. There's no wishing for breaks or having days off. This is what you're doing. All right, we get it. And it just clicked from there on. So, you know, by the end of the time, I was doing 60 to 70K a day, every day, and not even having an issue. Nothing hurt, nothing, you know. The only actual injury I sustained was in my mouth from eating too much, because you have to eat so much.
The inside of your mouth. You're fueling constantly.
Yeah, just fueling constantly. And your mouth has no time to recover. So it gets sore, just like anything, if you're using it too much. Because by the end of it, I was doing 60, 70K a day and consuming 12, 13,000 calories a day.
Wow. So what sort of things were you eating then to kind of give you that calorie content?
Yeah, you physically... You know, there were times there where I'd have the benefit of, you know, eating at a restaurant. You know, you paddle for 12 hours, you come in at Brighton, let's say, it's 1,000 restaurants. So you eat, but you have three meals off the, but in a way that, normally you eat one meal and you're stuffed. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't even dream about eating another, but you'd be so hungry that you would take you burger and chips, a curry, and something, you know, pizza or something, just to consume the calories. But on a normal day, obviously we're cooking for ourselves on the beach, and I'm cooking or sorting myself out. So you have lots of basically powder that goes on your food to just bump up the calorie intake, which is so boring, but actually nice, kind on your mouth.
Wow, of course, it's nothing you never think about. You think about, how like... the salt water would affect you, how you not your food, not your mouth getting sore from eating so much. That would be the last thing I think someone would say that they kind of struggled with on a paddleboarding trip. But
the stats of what I ate, as far as, you know, 25 tubs of peanut butter through to over 500 fairy cakes, you know, fairy cakes, not a particular favorite of mine, but they're so packed of sugar, those little fairy cakes, that especially the pink ones, they're the most packed with sugar. Just pump one of those in and you're off for 20 minutes. No problem.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Amazing. So I'd love to talk a bit about your charity Above Water, because it's, you know, where you're doing a lot of good, and it's where, I guess, the reason behind you doing this long paddle in the first place. So can you, I guess, tell listeners about the charity, how it all came about, and... kind of what your future plans are for it, because I think it is really fascinating. Obviously it comes from a very personal place, so I'd love to hear a little bit more about that.
So I mean, as a teacher, I could see there was this huge gap. So junior schools, so 4 to 11 age, primary school level, you are meant to be taught water safety. It's in the national curriculum, just like maths and English and everything else. And then in secondary school, it's kind of left to the devices of teachers who might have an understanding of the water, want to bring in an enrichment activity. You know, you might be in a school that is near an RLI station, so they might have RLI guards that come and do some great work for a one-off session. The problem with all of that is there's no consistency through. And anything like this, let's say crossing the road, for example, you know, they teach how to cross the road every year through your school career. And then in secondary school, it's kind of mentioned and you kind of got it by then. Now, water safety is not rocket science. You know, there's more elements to it, let's say, than crossing the road. But the fundamentals of stop, look and listen and teaching those elements is fairly similar. And yet we don't teach it. And the reason for not teaching it is as a primary school teacher, you know how to cross the road yourself, don't you? But let's say you're a primary school teacher in Coventry. You don't know about rips or cold water shock or how to float. So the teacher thinks, oh, I don't really know how to teach this. And if I teach it, I'm a professional. I want to get it right. So they don't teach it. And there's no...
I went to school inland. Can't say I have any memory of being taught any water safety at school.
There you go. And, you know, we find this all the time. So what I wanted to do was to bring a charity that fills the gap, that is helping teachers. Because another way of looking at it is all the resources are there. So all the greatest, amazing resources are there on the internet. But a teacher then has to go and get all those resources, understand them, and then teach them. And therein lies another barrier for teaching water safety, especially when it's not being assessed. So Ofsted don't assess and say, well done, because you've taught water safety, in the same way they would have done if you've got really good SAT results in primary school. So there's no, the incentive, and this is, you know, our school system, it's not against the teachers, it's not against the schools, but we only found that teachers who lived near the water, or perhaps didn't live near the water, so felt they need the need to try and engage, were doing anything about it. So Above Water was brought up because as a lifeguard, I could go into schools, teach what the teachers, you know, was in the curriculum 45 minutes and do that repeatedly every year. So a child, by the time they left primary school, had a real understanding of what to do if they fall into a canal, in the same way as if there was an issue at the coast. But of course, the major issue with, you know, the having enough lifeguards to do this just isn't, it's not scalable, not scalable. So prior to COVID, you know, we had 10, 20 lifeguards going into schools all over the country. What COVID did was make us step back and go, well, actually, unless we've got a team of 1,000 lifeguards, there's no way you could be going into the 28,000 schools teaching water safety. So let's try and think of another way of doing it. And the app route just seemed so logical. An app that was specific to an area or a beach. So, I mean, I did some water safety the other day in Coventry and in Birmingham. So there it's all about canal safety. It's all about understanding that type of water as opposed to coastal waters. So making it specific, an app specific to this. And that was the premise about raising money from the circumnavigation and get that ball rolling. I've actually taken a massive pivot because what was 100,000 4 years ago is now 1 million. In the world of technology. So we've gone, whoa, do we try and get this sorted for 2 or 3 million investment? And the only issue with apps is obviously the longevity, a month, 3 months, and they've got to keep renewing them. Otherwise, why is a child going to play it? You know, it's got to be, and a child's understanding of graphics, even only 4 years ago, compared to the Marvel Fortnite graphics now, means that if you're going to do an app, it's got to be good enough. Mm-hmm. And we think that we can make that happen, but we've taken a pivot of going back to what I think is genius. in that we now teach, we do training in areas where the schools come to us. They send three or four pupils, year five pupils, you know, the pupils that, you know, want to that bit of enrichment, but also enrich their own schools. So we train them to be young leaders. They go back to their schools and they actually do our training for us. And if they do it really well, they get t-shirts. And if they, you know, some schools even go into other schools and do train, you know, and we give them hoodies. So we get, you know, lots of incentive, and we're finding that is doing really well. But like I said, this pivot turn to do this, we haven't lost sight of the app. It just means that we've gone about it very differently. And there's some big things happening this year for the charity, you know, national level things that it's top secret at the minute, but it will be coming out very soon. And we're very excited about it. And I'm spending a lot of my time in that type of engagement to show what can be done in water safety. Because I said it's a nice sexy subject, but my Jove, you can really turn it into a subject that kids want to engage in if it's done in an exciting, passionate way, because the water's great fun. Now, I don't know a child who doesn't love water in some way, shape or form, and can benefit from it. And as an adult, how we can all benefit from that blue space and how it enriches our own lives. And I think a lot of parts of society are really understanding that, the cold water aspects. But that's just one tiny bit of this big picture of how it can enrich our lives. And like I said, we live on an island with this water everywhere.
Yeah, exactly. And it's so important that we understand. You know, I've got a 1-year-old daughter. I love water. I've always loved paddleboarding, surfing, all this sort of stuff. And now I've got a 1-year-old daughter. I'm thinking, oh my goodness, I'm petrified. the thought of her going out and enjoying, I want her to enjoy it. And obviously, like, the first thing we're going to be doing is dunking her in a couple of surf lessons as soon as she's old enough.
Yeah.
But also, there is that fear of, like, having to understand it, and will she have the knowledge? And like you say, we are surrounded by water, so it's so important. I love that you touched on this whole idea of blue space, because it's something I like to talk about on this podcast as well, is how important our natural environment is, and getting out and moving in nature is for our mind as well as our body, and also for the environment too. So I'd love if you have any sort of experiences of sharing how you have found moving in nature, be it paddleboarding, surfing, whatever you've done, and how it has affected your mental health, and also how it's affected your relationship with the environment.
Yeah, I mean, crikey. The environment that is, because I do mainly coastal paddling, and every day is a different day. Every wave is a different wave. And it was funny because we drove back from Cornwall yesterday, and coming over the Tamar Bridge into Plymouth, it was one of those proper, I mean, I know Plymouth very well and it rains there a lot, but the clouds were down, it was very grey. You could hardly tell the difference between the colour of the water and the colour of the sky. I said to my wife, they're one of my favourite days on the water because the conditions are always still when it's like that. And then when they are like that, you can only hear the life. You know, you can only hear the birds. You know, the birds in Scotland, it's a cacophony of noise. And you watch, you know, I never knew that puffins, the cute birds that are puffins, are literally the cannon fodder of our coastline. You know, everything eats puffins. Everything, love them. You know, you witness nature in its rawest sense, but also in its most magnificent sense. Seeing 20,000 seals on the beach in Norfolk, you know, it's a sight to behold. And these sort of magnitude of wildlife scenes, I didn't necessarily know that occurred on our beaches, but just a normal day. You know, the how many more seals, how many more dolphins that we see on our coastline? Because up to the last couple of years, our beaches and our water have been getting cleaner and cleaner and cleaner, and enabling this to happen. It's, you know, because of the political aspects now that's happening, that's in some places almost being reversed because of the gunk that's being put out there. But, you know, I saw in some parts you hardly see any litter at all, and then in other parts of our country it's just like every paddle is through litter, you know, and where it, and litter, you know, places in Scotland, beaches in Scotland, secluded beaches in Scotland, where the banks of seaweed that normally occur are being replaced by banks of plastic. And you go and you explore some of that plastic, and you can find things from 20, 30 years ago. And you know, and you can find everything. If it belongs to a human, you can find it's from laptops to shoes to if it floats and it can be chucked away, you can find it on a beach. And it's tragic. It really is tragic. But you know, there are lots of good things happening, and we're understanding and getting better at it. But it's still a long way to go. Still a long way to go. And we can see that on our own coastline. But for me personally, you know, my space, and this is why some of my followers, for example, will say, well, you've gone for a paddle, but you didn't take any photos. And you know, because probably nine out of every 10 of my paddles are for me. And I'm not one of these people that take a photo of everything I do and share it. So, you know, the dolphins and the seals and the wildlife I saw this weekend, I saw them, and that's enriched me. I didn't take photos because that would have spoiled my moment. Scrabbling around to get my camera to take a photo of the dolphin would have spoiled my moment. So I have to get a bit better at doing that because people want to see these things, and it's good enrichment and it's good engagement to talk about what we're doing. But I get a lot of satisfaction from my own paddling. And that's why people say, surely you've given up paddling now, you've done so much. But as far as I can see, it's just the start of it, really.
Yeah. Oh, and it's so true, isn't it? We do live in a world where if your photo wasn't taken, then it feels like it didn't happen, which is really, really
sad. Rubbish.
Yeah, it is. And someone even said it to me the other day. This is something along the lines of they'd gone cold water swimming. They were like, they said, isn't it like a rite of passage that if you go cold water swimming, you have to document it? You know? And I was like, yeah, I get that. Like people, you know, you do. And it's, and I guess somebody in your position as well, where you feel like you're promoting, enjoying being outdoors, enjoying our coastline, enjoying water and keeping safe. You've always got responsibility to document it.
Yeah, you've got to balance that. You've got to balance it.
But it's so important that you do take time. And actually I've started to do this thing personally where on my weekends, I don't touch social media. I don't look at it. I don't document whatever's going on in my life on social media. Monday to Friday, a bit different, but my weekends are the step for me to do it. And it does make a massive, massive difference because blue space is incredible. We're very good at promoting about that on social media, but is it incredible if you're documenting it yourself? Maybe not.
Well, again, there's a balance. And some people are very natural at not spoiling their experience by doing that, but for most it will inhibit and get in the way of the experience by getting your camera out and trying to document it. So with everything, it's a balance, and the balance is different for different people.
Absolutely, but then it also raises awareness, which is important, which is what we need. So
exactly but there's so many times when I've thought, you need to get your camera out now. You need to get the camera out now. You know, I've had dolphins jump over my board through to killer whales, to all sorts. And you think, perhaps I should get my camera out now. And you think, no, because I just saw that. Mm-hmm. And there have been times when I have gone to get my camera and I've missed it and I've seen the splash on it. So, yeah, it's always that balance.
Yeah, exactly. You're like a stream up. You employ a cameraman to be behind you.
And it's also those things, I've seen things come out of the water that shouldn't be in this country and shouldn't be here, but I've seen them. So like,
I'm thinking a lot less monster right now. What?
Yeah, there's just stuff in the water that if you spend enough time there, you think, did I just see that? You know, whether it be sharks through to unexplained creatures coming out of the water. There's stuff out there, and I think that's what's amazing about the fact that we know so little about our ocean. Mm-hmm. I was just reading something about the Marianas Trench because I always find it fascinating, and it's a place I want to paddle across. You know, just how little we know about what's down there.
Mm-hmm.
And with our flows and our currents and what's happening, the way things are warming up, who knows around our British coastline what we will get appearing, you know?
It's so true. Because there's been that sea line that keeps popping up. Where is it?
There's a walrus that keeps popping up all over the place.
It. Yeah. A walrus, and it stopped at some New Year's celebration. It's on the fireworks somewhere, didn't it, over New Year?
Because
he was in the wrong place at the wrong time, but you have to respect that. Okay, well, Brendan, I've loved talking to you, and I'd like to ask you one final question, which is a question I ask everybody on this podcast, and that is, looking back at the ripples you've made in your life, what are the biggest lessons that you've learned keeping your mind and your body healthy?
Whoa.
That's what everyone always says.
We're taught at school to read and write and run. We're not taught in schools to breathe. Breathing is such a huge part of all of our lives. We all have to do it. Breathing, for me, I learned a lot about myself. I found out before, in big situations on a board, got big waves, I was finding that I was holding my breath. And the only reason I knew that is because I've got one of those watches now that tells you all that, and which tells you exactly when you're breathing and not. And I was like, really? So when I most need oxygen is when I was starving myself of it. And there was one other time in my life that was regularly happening, and that was 8:30 in the morning before I opened my emails. Take a deep breath and you hold. And I'm having a life now where I'm breathing all the time dramatically changes things, because you're flooding yourself with oxygen when you need it to make decisions. So that's something I take from the long paddle moving forward into the next however many years, that has really helped my understanding of situations. So something unfolds, bad news, whatever, just breathing, giving yourself the opportunity to be able to react to it in the best way, means that you don't react rashly, you don't overreact, you don't get angry. All those sort of emotions come from a position of lack of oxygen, and that's so fundamental. So that's probably, if there was a practical thing I could learn from the ripples, but then also probably the main thing is that with every ripple I create, hopefully a child somewhere makes a right decision rather than a wrong decision about water. And that's the main thing. And it would be wrong of me and remiss of me not to say, to take from this as an adult, someone who is near water, to just say, whenever you go near water, stop, take a moment just to see what's happening. Look, so really have a good look if there's dangers or not. Listen, speak to other people who are going on the water or not, or being out there, and just understand the environment. And if it all goes horribly wrong, float. And whilst you're floating, make a decision. So stop, look, listen, float is the simple message to everybody listening, that if you could share that, could save a life one day.
Oh, that's incredible. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. And if anybody wanted to follow your journey, find out a little bit more about Above Water, how can they do that?
Well, socials, Above Water UK on Insta, Twitter, Facebook. I'm on all those as well as Brendan Prince, and the Long Paddle, Long Paddle SUP. If you put that into all of it, that kind of catalogues the journeys and world record attempts I might be doing this year, and all the general paddling that I'm doing.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much. Really, really enjoyed chatting to you today. And yeah, I think that's brilliant. Was it look, listen?
Stop, look, listen,
stop,
float.
Look, listen, float.
Yes.
Yeah, that's your takeaway from today.
God bless you. Thank you, India. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Start a Ripple podcast. If you like what you heard, then please do write a review. It helps other like-minded souls find this podcast too. And if you want to get in touch, then the best way to speak to me is probably via Instagram. And my handle is @with_India. All right, take care and speak to you soon.